Welcome to the 78th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Kaylin Egan.
My name is a high-energy Travis Sintel.
And we have a real special guest today, but we're not going to talk about him yet. We're just not going to talk about him because...
He's staring at us while we're doing this.
Because I want to real quick wrap up one thing, one hanging chad from last episode, which is that we listened to the song... So to answer our own question, yes, the weird Steve Martin fake mentally disabled character is a part of the play, as I thought he would be.
Rupert.
He would have to be. And we were wondering, how did they handle this in the play, this problem, this issue? And so we listened to the song devoted to it. And how do they do it, Travis? There's a very simple answer. Inbreeding!
Oh.
That's how they solve the problem, inbreeding. And so that is the only what I now understand is that is the only way to get away with this kind of offensive characterization. Still, inbreeding is not yet a taboo.
Yeah.
So who's going to stick up for the inbred kids?
To be clear, inbreeding is a taboo. Disgusting inbreeding, not a taboo.
Right.
I want to be clear to the listener. We do think inbreeding is a taboo. Don't say
it's just weird. It's just weird to me that that's not – that is still – I mean, that's like Eve has this huge issue with white trash parties because like white trash remains like the safe space. And then this – it's a very similar idea here is like, well, we can still get away with it. Anyway.
I love inbreeding parties.
Well, welcome to the party. Let's get into it.
Who the hell said that? That looks to me like Adrian Todd Zuniga.
Hey!
Thanks for having me, guys.
Adrian's on a whirlwind book tour and flew by Los Angeles just to do our podcast because our reach is so wide in terms of the literary community. We're hoping to sell loads of books off this appearance.
Upwards of 3 books is my goal.
Okay, that feels plausible.
There's no way. There's no way we
well,
can hit that.
Well, Kaylin and I are going to buy one. So does that count?
Oh,
we
that's
buy one
together. You'll be like, could you assign it to both of us? I'm like, you really couldn't buy two?
right.
Yeah.
So at least one book here and maybe 2 others. My mom might be listening.
Seriously, I would, like, the book is called Collision Theory, and if you listen to this podcast and buy it, and you will, like, be like, whoa, this is one of my favorite books, I would love to hear about it. I would just be blown away by that.
I will say, we would also be blown away by that if that specific scenario happened.
Right.
Adrian's very, Adrian Todd, what should we call you on the podcast?
Call me Adrian or Todd or Adrian Todd-Zuniga or...
ATZ.
Yeah.
ATZ is very active on social media, and we'll respond to all of your queries, questions, and compliments.
Yeah,
almost
exactly.
Certainly.
When we should tell the story of how we even know him. This is the one of the people who, now that we're 78 in, but since episode 1, it was like, oh yeah, obviously we'll have Todd on at some point. Like, obviously he will come on, and it will be amazing. It'll be so funny. And it took us this long to get there because he moved out of the fucking country.
Like
he just
like
vanished.
Dipshit.
This guy was an L.A. institution. He still is, I would argue. He was an L.A. institution until he just picked up his bags and disappeared.
Well, now he's an American institution.
He
spread his wings.
Right.
And now when
he
travels the world, he's like, oh, American institution, Adrian Todd Zuniga, is now in the Netherlands or in... Denmark.
Did you move out of the country pre-Trump or post-Trump election?
Pre-Trump.
Yeah, so you saw that shit coming.
But I was in Florida when it happened, and I turned to my best friend, a co-writer on a couple projects. I turned to him and I said, there's going to be some amazing art in the next 4 years. And it's already happening, mostly out of my laptop. I mean, I am really blown away by myself.
I should also say, very subtle.
Collision Theory.
Right.
I'm not going to let you pitch the plot yet. I'm going to tell listeners... that the in terms of writing, one of the most interesting things about Adrian Todd Zuniga recently is that he was nominated for a WGA award for a video game script that he wrote, which feels to me like somewhat the future. Oh, big! I just got back from TED. There was a big schism at TED about video game storytelling. We should offline that. But it's really, really – it is a big thing in happening in the world of AR, VR, video game storytelling, all these different possibilities for storytelling potential and how to do it. But in front of us here is one of the guys on the cutting edge of that.
Because
he's been nominated for a writing award for a video game.
And I want to hear Todd talk about this, but I also want to sort of – by way of introducing him as a character on the show, here's the thing. Like there was a time, I am sure, when – Todd said, among 99 other things, oh yeah, I'm writing a video game for EA Sports Madden. And I was like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it was one of the, because Dodd says a lot of stuff, and it's not that he's, like, lying or, like, selling, you know, he's got a lot of great schemes and stuff in the hopper. And when he said he's writing a thing for EA, I was like, whatever fraction of truth that is, this is the last I'll ever hear about it. Until he gets nominated and then, like, for an award.
Mahershala Ali is in our game.
And the book comes out.
Yeah,
and it's
that's
a huge
so
thing.
Crazy.
And
yeah.
It's like, man, like, this guy.
And
like,
I didn't even know. I opened my Writers Guild monthly magazine, and it was a big interview with Adrian Tanzaniga.
Well, right. And yeah. The compliment I am trying to pay by sort of implying
not
that
going
he's a,
well.
He's a con artist.
The compliment is not going scheme, well. And then yeah. Compliment is always
it's not a great compliment. Yeah.
But what I mean
although
is,
for Kalen, this is about as good as it
what
gets.
What I mean
compliment.
Is, everyone talks about how the way to be successful as a writer in L.A. is to just fire arrow after arrow after arrow after arrow. And so Todd shoots all these arrows, and then these incredible ones score, you know? Like, and that's, I mean, the same is true for you and I, is that we try to write all these different things, and most of them just sort of fizzle out or
I mean,
abandon
to be fair, Todd
whatever.
Has a howitzer, and we have, like, a pea shooter. Like, we just, yeah. We every, like, it's 3 true. Years, we'll shoot a shot.
Yes,
and
yes.
And by that point,
you yeah. Think I have a howitzer, but that's all, it just shoots like that every once in a while, because I literally have so many projects that have gunked up the gun, it's all jammed. I was like, right. Oh, we got, oh, God, and then,
blah.
Yeah, it doesn't
and then all
shoot.
The ones come out at once.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
In any case, we're super stoked to have him on. If it took a book tour and relentless self-promotion to get you on our wide-reaching, wide-ranging podcast, so be it.
I am so excited because literally from the start, I was just like, oh, man, I'm going to be on that all the time.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
literally
yeah, yeah.
78 episodes.
I know.
I'm very
and we
excited.
Only we told ourselves we were only going to do like 100 of them. So right. you're getting in right,
just
right,
getting
right
in
just in time.
This is a sweet spot. And this is where we've hit our stride, but we're not yet maudlin about the possibility of it ending.
Right. Yeah,
so this is really
true.
Our heyday.
This kind of is. That's true. This is kind of the sweetest possible spot because we're fucking good at this point.
Obviously. So. Our last episode really demonstrated our professionalism.
Yeah. Let's see if you can top the last guest, my 2.5-year-old son.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's pretty good.
The only discernible words he said were poo-poo, right. Duty.
That's pretty good.
Okay. Let's move into... Well, continue to introduce yourself throughout the entire thing and talk about whatever you want. But by way of sort of constructing a conversation, let's move into the usual suspects. So you've come for, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, the most obviously loaded episode of this entire series so far.
You're talking about Singer Spacey.
Yeah. I mean, this is a show, as you know, about nostalgia and revisiting art from the past and seeing how it holds up now, and my God, has a lot come up.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Mm-hmm.
I will suggest to the trio of us white males that we I would like to separate this discussion out, because I think I want to have both these discussions. I am not confident, I'm fairly sure, but I'm not completely confident that The Usual Suspects as a film, even if none of the stuff is attached to it, holds up the way that we remember it. I'm not confident that's true. So I just want to go on record as saying that it's held up as a masterpiece. I remember thinking it was probably a masterpiece at the time. I'm not confident that's true anymore. And I want to see that. I also would like to talk about the thing Kalen is raising here.
Right.
So it may help us to parse those out.
And as usual, I don't mean to raise that to say that's all we're going to be talking about, but it's so huge that there are two vital figures in sort of 90s American cinema who have had long careers and only in the last 6 months are essentially toast. I mean, I guess the story on Bryan Singer has not yet fully been told, but we aren't going to see any Kevin Spacey.
No,
I would say he's done.
Yeah, and this movie sort of launched them both into the stratosphere.
Totally
so to
launched
and,
them both.
And a lot of the accounts of the Kevin Spacey behavior come out of this film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a lot of accounts of him on set of this film. Even not a megastar at that point.
Well, even, I mean, not to spread rumors, but even in direct conflict with Singer over men, you know, guys. I don't know any more about it than that.
This is a good intro.
It's interesting to me because when Kalen, like, I've wanted to be on this podcast forever, and I have a lot of opinions about movies throughout time, and it would be interesting to revisit them. But when Kalen turned to me the other night and said, hey, we're doing it and we're doing Usual Suspects, I immediately go, oh my God, that's fascinating. I think of that as a perfect movie.
Aha. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, how incredible that my first reaction once I was getting in the car driving back home, I was like, is there a woman in this movie? Like, that's that already. Right. And just the way I write and the way I try to think of you know, utilizing the world in terms of these things. And I was like, yeah, I'm really interested in that.
Yeah.
And just to see how that reads.
So when did you last, we almost talked about this before the show started, but when did you last see it?
I don't know if I've seen it in 20, or I would say 15 years.
Yeah.
I'd say 15 years is a safe. Yeah, because I remember in college, because what year did it come out? 80s?
95.
Yeah,
really?
So.
I think. So, yeah. 94.
95. No, 95 or 96. This is a post-Pulp Fiction movie, yeah, importantly.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to go with 95.
This is in that post-Pulp Fiction wave of American crime movies.
It doesn't say on this thing I'm looking at, but I trust that we just know. But, yeah. Oh,
we're,
95.
We're close.
We're very close.
Bad Hat Harry, 95.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say at least 15 years, maybe 16, 17, but yeah. So.
Yeah, because I mean, I owned it. It was one of those movies that I owned and saw. I've seen it a dozen times, mm-hmm. for sure. But same. Certainly not in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
Same.
And my girlfriend made a, well, just about a week ago, I made a reference to this movie, and I said basically something about the last line, but instead of saying the devil, you know, the devil's.
Yes.
Yeah. I used Kaiser Soze, and she started laughing. And I was like, are you impressed by me calling up a reference to that movie? She goes, no, it's not Kaiser Soze, it's the devil. And I was like, oh, yeah. And then I was ready to move on, and she would not let it go. She's like, no. It's the devil.
The framework of the conversation of are you impressed by my reference? No, you got the reference wrong. Is an amazing couple interaction that I'm really
into. I was so excited. And I remained excited that I had made the reference.
But. I will say that in terms of penetrating culture, what a fucking terrible phrase. In terms of something making its way into the culture in a really deep, meaningful way, like this film really stuck. Like everyone knew Kaiser Soze. Everyone knew this movie. It was one of those water cooler movies that was just inescapable for, I'd say, at least a decade afterwards. Yeah.
Well, the magnificence of the movie. I mean, here's me like anticipating just the movie experience. I mean, as a kid, and I was a kid when I saw it, and I remember that very vividly, going with my dad to the theater, same theater where I first saw Pulp Fiction. It's all about the ending, and then in the ensuing years, if there is any controversy about whether the movie is good or not, it's all about, well, can a movie with an ending that negates the entire movie be a good movie? That's the experience the thing I'm most interested in looking at now.
Yeah,
I
want to know.
If the movie says in the last minute, that was all bullshit, the end, you know, like, can that still be a good movie? My guess, if I'm going to take an honest guess, I think I'm going to love this. I think I'm going to have a really good time watching the movie. The only shadow looming over it is going to be Spacey and Singer. That's it.
I hope
that's true.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I'm excited about. I've been really wanting to go revisit this movie purely for Benicio del Toro reasons.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, because I remembered him. I was pretty obsessed with him as an actor. I saw that movie Beautiful, and I thought it was so great. And that's Javier Bardem. Sorry.
Yeah. Holy God.
Sorry. Racist. But when I was going back to his oeuvre from Last Jedi and sort of thinking back over some of his things, and I was like, what happened to that guy? And where was his space?
Yeah. What do you mean? What happened? You mean how? Did
in
he
terms
get here?
Of his career, yeah. Like, because he starts here, and it becomes he takes on such crazy roles. Because we did Fear and Loathing on this podcast.
Right.
And that came right after this film, right? The next year or something?
Soon enough. A few years.
But watching the wild entry he has into Hollywood and the wild characters he's playing, and this is the one sort of famously wild character that he played that I haven't gone back and revisited since I sort of grew up as a person. Point. So I want to see this guy doing his weird sort of mumblecore dialogue.
Mumblecore. Well, he is, I mean, I hope I said it during Fear and Loathing, but it's something I believe. I think that he's like top five best living actors. Like, I think Del Toro said that.
That's interesting.
Well, I think he is just unbelievable.
And
I think
he has stayed there. Unreal.
Sicario is the thing that I was watching it. It's funny. I thought of this watching Sicario, and then also I thought it when I was watching that kind of bad Oliver Stone movie Savages, based on the Don Winslow book. And I was like, Benicio del Toro is an international treasure. Like, what this guy does is unlike any other actor. And he has, funnily enough, and also thinking about Fear and Loathing, he has kept on the freak train. Like, he doesn't play normal people. Yeah. And so to me, and very much including Sicario, is like, but what he can do with exuberant sort of flamboyance, broad acting, and what he can do with not like almost non-acting, which is his Sicario performance, and have so much presence and power. I'm like, I don't know an actor who can do that. Even actors I would think are like, man, maybe they're better than Benicio del Toro. They can't do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, just
unique.
Well,
I think that's what it is. It strikes me that he is a risk taker in certain ways and does wild things. And that's why this movie stood out to me, is that he's a young, sort of basically unknown guy in a very localized community doing this film and takes a wild shot that, as I understand, is not the way that character was scripted initially.
Right. I don't know about that, but that could be right.
He comes out swinging and does a really wild, wacky thing, and that strikes me as something he's maintained.
Well, I don't know how you would ever write that character.
Exactly, yeah. I think I remember, we all did this. We went and read articles about this movie, I'm sure, and looked into it or whatever, but one of the things I remember is that he made this choice to be basically incomprehensible in certain scenes, and people didn't know what to do about it set. I think they're a little perplexed by that decision.
After they cast him?
Yeah, I think so. I want to look at that through that lens. I mean,
yeah, the flip you for real line. Oh, my God. I've used that line just in my life.
I could still – that whole thing, him knocking and going, can you hear me in the back? Hello? it's so amazing. Oh, everything God. He does is amazing in this movie.
Yeah.
And his interplay, even with Kevin Pollak, we've talked about him before as being, he was terrible in Willow, but is very nicely used in this movie, as I recall. Anyway, the point is, I have nothing but fond feelings about this movie as in my life and as an experience and as a sort of discovery of all these incredible people. I'm still very nervous about it because of this other thing.
Right. Well, that part, but the ending thing you said is interesting because it just hit me. This is sort of an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
It's almost in the inventing of M. Night Shyamalan this movie is all about this twist.
Yeah.
I'm nervously excited. Here's what happened. And maybe this is, people understand this. Maybe I'm just saying the same thing over again. I pulled it out of the bag, saw the title, and I was like, yeah, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
I was like that.
Yeah,
I was very excited, and then I was like, oh, no.
I know, I'm also worried that something will be dead in me after we watch this, you know, and I'll be like, oh, man, you killed something that was marvelous.
That's what our podcast does. That's the entire structure of our podcast. That's the whole point,
right? Yeah.
And I guess, to state it, even though I think we all know, the question here is, basically, can you separate art from the artist? Can you enjoy something, even given the sort of knowing who the real people are?
Which actually is a decision you guys will have to make when you read Collision Theory. Because...
Wait. Travis, how am I using your voice to talk about my book? It's weird.
I'm just saying, you'll have to really separate what you hear on this podcast from the beauty of the book, which is lovely, but...
And I just, I did write a mystery. I didn't mean to, but there's mystery. Hashtag mystery.
All right.
Hashtag mystery. We're going to let you talk more about the book on the back end.
Ooh, I have more stuff to say about Christopher McQuarrie, too, after
this. Yeah, great. Okay, no. How do we not even talk about Chris McQuarrie yet?
I mean...
Who's Christopher McQuarrie?
He was a screenwriter. But he's directing Mission Impossible now.
Well, I'll just say it now, because it doesn't actually...
I want to talk about this guy.
It doesn't really apply to the movie. And so maybe after we watch the movie, we can talk more about him in context of the movie. But one thing I've heard about him, I've been fascinated about, is that he talks about his early career as sort of taking the lesson of, don't let anybody in, do not collaborate, hold tight to your art and your script. And he's like... And that's Usual Suspects, that's Way of the Gun, that's a couple of other things he wrote and sort of worked on his own. And then he's like, but what I discovered is that when you just do what they want, you become a fucking multimillionaire.
Yeah.
And he's like, my career went crazy as soon as I stopped fighting for my own art. I think he meant it in a semi-defeat of I had to let go. But I'm sure he's proud of the work he's done with Tom Cruise and shit. But it's clearly a separation between I'm just going to go for the commerce.
And interestingly, I mean, it's a clear decision with him. I agree. And what's interesting about him, though, is that he got into that through rewrites. They called him in to script doctor stuff, which doesn't feel like a full concession. It feels like, cool, I'm doing my thing. I'll get some money. I'll do this. Loved working with Tom Cruise, allegedly. Had a good time. And then Tom Cruise was the one who was like, come do this. Come direct this. Yeah. And now he's a big shot director guy doing big, spectacle movies, mostly Mission Impossible stuff. But his career is really interesting to me because he's a very, very smart guy with good sensibilities, I think, who made a very clear decision.
Yes.
He made a right turn into something. And he never would have been a director had he not done that to this level. He might have directed some films and things, but he really took a spaceship to the...
Well, I'm a big fan of that, do what you believe. I mean, I collaborate to do those things sometimes, but I'm an artist, and I believe in myself as an artist. But I also think there is going to be a time, if I'm lucky, that I'm going to – I don't know if I have to check my art at the door, but that I'm going to get projects that are beyond the scope of quote-unquote art. But then if you – if that's what's really in your heart, then ideally what's going to happen, he's going to make these, and then he's going to have money and the confidence and the bearing to go like, you know what I really want to make? Like this weird ass.
It's possible.
Something.
Although that is possible. Although I don't pretend to speak for him, but I think what he's sort of saying is like, you know, whatever art I'm squeezing in there is a byproduct of giving the money man what they want. And it feels like a significant shift in terms of his outlook and his priority as a filmmaker.
I also feel it's interesting too, because while Usual Suspects is such a beloved and maybe soon to be destroyed movie, it's still a popular movie.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's
no,
not
right,
like
right.
People
totally.
Like it.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally.
People like it and talk about it. And totally. It wasn't like he was making just some weirdo, like strange thing. He, you know, so it doesn't seem to me crazy that he's directing Mission Impossible.
No,
that does seem
that's
like a
true. And yet, in order to get there, he had to go through Way of the Gun and stuff like
right.
that. And Way of the Gun is a movie I actually quite like because it's so idiosyncratic and so constantly resisting an anti mainstream popular art. I mean, it like makes it goes out of. I remember even reading the script for that movie, and it goes so far out of its way to slam mainstream art that it's like it's super weird.
He wrestles with that. I think there's two parts to him too. One is I think he's a structural writer, and by that I mean I think he's very good at sort of taking modular set pieces, understanding how scripts work together. I think this script kind of does some of that, you know, structural work. So I think part of his brain is a mechanical sort of problem-solving brain. Hmm. And I think the Mission Impossible things do genuinely appeal to him. That's a lot of problem-solving writing, basically.
Yeah.
But I think there's also this artistic schism within him to be, quote-unquote, an artist versus, quote-unquote, populist or whatever.
Right,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I think he's a fascinating guy. And all the interviews he gives are really – I love all of them. I like the way he talks about it, actually.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. All right, let's go watch this thing.
What's all that?
Right. Stand by for the twist ending.
Did you say right. West Side?
I didn't say West Side. I said, what's that? But now I'm going to change it to West Side.
West Side.
All right. You all know the drill. When your number is called, step forward and repeat the phrase you've been given. Understand? Number one, step forward.
Hand me the keys, you fucking cocksucker.
Number two, step forward.
Give me the fucking keys, you fucking cocksucker motherfucker!
Knock it off, get back. Number three, step forward.
Hand me the keys, you cocksucker.
In English, please.
Excuse me?
In English.
Hand me the fucking keys, you cocksucker. What the fuck?
Number four, step forward.
It was bullshit. The whole rap was a setup.
Hand me the keys, you fucking cocksucker.
It was all the cops' fault. You don't put guys like that into a room together. Who knows what can happen?
Hand me the keys, you fucking cocksucker.
I don't want to start.
Kaiser. I just want to know how Todd got that quote wrong. Because it is a crazy quote to get wrong. The greatest trick Kaiser Soze
ever
pulled
was teaching the world.
Oh boy,
whatever the world.
You don't have it now.
I can't even say it right now.
I'll start off a little contentiously, perhaps.
Okay, let's hear it.
So I really enjoyed myself. That's not the contentious part. The contentious part is for a criminal mastermind, I don't think he's that creative of a storyteller in the moment, and he adds a lot of extraneous details that feel unnecessary and arbitrary. Like, and that's something I didn't really, that didn't bug me. That doesn't bug me, but it didn't register when I was a child.
Are you talking about like the barbershop quartet thing?
All the Skokie, all the things that actually are on the board.
Right.
Really.
Right.
Which is like three things.
Yeah. But the way it's shot gives
boy,
the impression.
Boy, there are sure a lot of pans across that
which
cluttered
is
board.
The movie lying to you, in effect. Which I didn't really register.
Well,
so that's a little bit
of
a structure complaint.
This is actually not something we usually do, is sort of unpack the actual content of a movie. But I, now that you're on that point in the last scene, I do want to ask, like, he's only, the idea is he's only adding in those details so that he'll see it eventually and be like, oh my God, I almost had him. Like, that's the whole point of him saying any of that stuff, right?
No. I think he's just like, looking around and he's sort of pulling stuff, and I think he's just trying to kill time, right? Isn't that really his goal?
It's
like,
one of two. Well, he's got 2 hours to kill. That's built into the plot. I think there's a bit of verisimilitude of like, he's a talking guy, just says all these details. Right. He's not, the more someone talks, you think he's not lying. He's spilling everything he's ever thought about right now in this moment.
Well, but all he has to do is sit there and be like, I'm not saying anything. Yeah. Right. That's all he has to do.
He's saying, convince me. I mean, that's the beat at the end. It's like, convince me that, you know, and then he's like, oh, so to convince him, he had to like, details are convincing.
I think there's some,
he doesn't convince him of anything. He just tells him.
He does in the moment. He lets him work himself into the fact that, that Gabriel Byrne is Kaiser,
which is the premise he comes into the room with. I mean, basically.
Yeah, but that's what there's a line in the film somewhere. Where he's like, people will basically tell you what they want to be convinced of, and like that, let them do it. So that's what he does. Fine. Sure. That question hinges. We're getting really in the weeds right away, but that question
I don't like this.
I agree, but that question hinges on whether or not he believes everyone from the boat died. I think in a certain way, because if someone can identify him who's still alive, then he is in fact just killing time, playing cat and mouse with the cops, and giving Chaz Palminteri what he needs to know.
I can't believe how bored I am listening to you talk about this.
Kaylin says, by the way, wait, Chad, just to get to prep you, Kaylin says that sentence every episode, and then later on realizes that was actually very interesting. And apologizes. But usually that's off air. So
not this time.
I was zoning out.
Not this time.
But I also thought
exactly.
It was interesting.
Exactly.
I also thought it was interesting.
Well, why don't you kick it off, Todd? What did you think? How did it stack up for you? Just straight up as a movie all by itself.
I was I'll just say I thought it was great. And I thought the moment in which this will happen to me in certain movies where I go, oh man, this movie's great. There was a moment specifically that happened. Should I talk about that?
Yes.
It was when Pete Postlethwaite / Kobayashi gives them the briefcase. Mm-hmm. And that moment, like that was like the final deal, you know, like they had
like with their stuff in it, you mean?
Stuff was in it when he just like they left. He has a gift for you.
Yeah.
And because at that point he's like, what, tell me what, so I don't kill you or whatever. And he's like, well, I have this gift. And for whatever reason, that was the moment. ultimately, like when it ended, I was like, that was great. But I do have some feelings about it.
Yeah.
Can I ask? I don't want to mess up the podcast.
There's no format.
Why does he have immunity? How does he get immunity?
Oh, I can tell you that. I know that.
Okay, because I was like...
So unnamed political forces have somehow acted to release Verbal Kent from prison and suppress his sentence. That's what we're told up top. Okay. Now, Chaz Palminteri's theory is that that's Gabriel Byrne coming in to be like, look, someone's putting pressure on us to let you go. I don't know who that is, but I have my theory. My theory is it's this guy and he's not dead. And actually, it's because it's Kaiser Soze and he's got minions all over the place who are putting political pressure. So that's how he got immunity.
But immunity? What from what? Like from he was holding a gun outside of a boat that got blown to shit. Yeah. Although it was just like a weird flaming whatever. And I've got other issues, but we'll start there. But like, I don't. What do you get immunity from? Like, what's immunity is granted because you give something and then you get immunity. Generally speaking,
well,
I guess
Chaz Palminteri doesn't know, and he got he got immunity from having to do further testimony, and his records are sealed. His testimony is sealed.
Right.
Which.
Oh God!
But would his testimony tell the truth? I mean, is this like would he be like, "I'm Kaiser Soze, and this is my sealed testimony"? Like,
well, hold on. Kaylin has something very smart to say. He wants to impress us with his intelligence. Kaylin, by all means, please say something
smart
and witty.
Any
smart
thing I might have had to say has
you've really thrown the gauntlet. You better say something brilliant.
Right now. Plot-based conversation.
Please say something so smart, Caleb.
I'm saving up my thing.
No,
what
do
is your,
it.
What
Enlighten
do you
us.
Think? Did you like it?
No, no. I want you to talk.
Did you like the movie?
I want you to say the smart thing you want to say.
It's not smart until you tell me if you like the movie.
Not interested.
It's in response to that.
Please go on.
I think this movie's pretty bad.
Oh really?
Yeah. It's okay. It's only bad because it's okay. That's sort of my ultimate takeaway on this thing. And I was surprised to be, as I was watching it, I wasn't like deflating with, you know, a lot of disappointment or whatever. But as it went on, I was like, well, let me put it this way. This is not really about the movie, but it's about Kevin Spacey.
Right.
Where I was watching this movie, and I think that the scandal had made me forget that Kevin Spacey kind of sucks. Like the fact that he went down and it was like, ooh, great actor Kevin Spacey. And I was like, huh, I guess that guy was a great actor. And I'm watching this and I'm like, now I remember I never liked Kevin Spacey.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, that's fair.
I did think several times throughout, I was like, a lot of other people could have done this.
You know?
Well, he won a. It's crazy because a supporting he won a supporting actor Oscar for a script trick. That's why he won. Yeah, like he didn't do anything really. Like he's okay. Like he's fine in this. Yeah. But
he bent up his hand.
Yeah, and then like it could can you win an award because of a shot where you go from a gimpy foot to a straight foot? Because that's what he won for.
He did win it for that moment. He does. Which is an exhilarating moment.
It is a great moment. He does give a creepy blank-eyed stare better than any other actor around this time.
Yeah, but I actually think he didn't do a very good job overall, like rewatching it, knowing the trick. Like there are moments when he's not being, because he does this head shake thing, and that's when you know he's true verbal Kent. But he sort of doesn't do that enough. Like he doesn't really like dial into that super hardcore.
Yeah, there was so much less to this movie than I thought, than I remembered. And that threw me consistently where I was like, when's this going to like, when's it like for me? I was I don't think you're wrong for saying it's great because it's kind of great in this really weird way, and it was original at the time, and it sort of does a lot of stuff. And I actually like the thing I liked most about it was Bryan Singer's sort of broad, old fashioned, ostentatious filmmaking. I thought that stuff was like fun, if a little bit old fashioned and kind of hokey in a way, but like. So I thought that was cool, but the characters and the story and like the reveal, I was like, what?
Well, just
like,
to reiterate the point I opened with, I do think the movie's hollow on a fundamental level.
Right,
that was my point in opening that way. Yeah. I think that is true. In fact, that this is a fundamentally hollow film.
Yeah, I actually agree with Kalen as well.
Yeah, no.
While I think it's great, I also am like. Is it good?
It's like that's a weird. Perfect. That's you know exactly what?
He pulls it off. Like he does that thing that certain movies do, where you're just like dazzled, and then afterwards you sort of start. It's like the
feeling
test.
Of being dazzled. Yeah, like, huh? Like what? Like and I mean, it's not that the movie. It's like not even faking it. It's like barely a twist.
No,
really.
It's you know the phrase Wells' third option.
No.
This is a great example of it. So it refers to Citizen Kane, and the idea is that when you write a screenplay with some sort of mystery intrigue, you should have the plot, option A, which is what the audience sees and watches. Option B, which is the thing you want them to suspect that they're go digging for, and they think might be the actual thing. Option C is the real thing at the end.
Okay.
So this is a good example of Wells' third option. We're supposed to think that there's a trick, obviously. Something, it's Gabriel Byrne, he's the bad guy. In fact, it's this. So, you know, it's not a revolutionary structure by any means.
Well,
it's a standard sort of structure.
I don't mind that structure at all. I wish that were more coherently or expertly done. I can't remember watching this the first time through. Maybe you guys had a more acute experience of this. But I was like, I couldn't follow the arrows to make me think it was Gabriel Byrne. Like fucking story about him being Turkish and German fathers and like, but Gabriel Byrne supposedly an ex-cop. And I'm like, how am I supposed to be putting these pieces together?
Oh, that's interesting.
And then in the end, Chaz Palminteri is like, well, there is no Kaiser Soze. And I was like, is that what I was supposed to be thinking? Is that there is this fake character that Gabriel Byrne maybe says he is. So therefore he's killing, you know, Hungarians. Like I was just like, I don't know. And then in the end, it's like, nope, it was Kevin Spacey. And I'm like, whatever, like who cares?
Well, that you make a good point, which is like the movie didn't give us the arrow. Like we know now what happened, but the movie didn't actually give us the arrows to say it's Kevin Spacey. And it also didn't give us the arrows to say it was Gabriel Byrne.
Mm-hmm.
It actually just like vagued it up and entertained us. And at the end, it's like, the cop decides it's Gabriel Byrne, and then we feel an exhilaration because we're like, oh, shit, that's amazing. Now I get it. And then all of a sudden we find it's the other one, and then we get our dick hooked into our ear. That's not a phrase I would ever use.
Where I expected to find entertainment, we didn't talk about this in the intro, but what I expected to find interesting was the watching it again with some distance and saying, okay, cool, here's the real things, here's the fake things, and the joy would come from extricating the reality from the fake, now knowing what the reality is.
Yeah.
There's not much of that at all that's joyful. There's an intercutting of real things, scenes we know are real, and scenes in retrospect we know were sort of fabricated or twisted around. And there's not a lot of joy separating those out or finding moments of realness that he had to justify post hoc in the office.
Right.
That's where I thought it might be fun.
Yeah.
And it's not There's not that fun.
Yeah, that doesn't happen in the way. And that's what I think. That's why what makes a movie go from like we loved it or to like it's ultimately forgettable versus like, wow, this is a masterpiece.
Yeah. So why? I mean, but let me sort of go back and start over, because there are a lot of good things about the movie in certain ways. It's got a pretty great tone. It feels cool throughout, even though what dates it worst are the 90s crime cool shit. Like, Stephen Baldwin is embarrassing at every second he's on screen.
That sentence is set often, though.
Yeah, but I didn't think that back then. Like, I didn't know how fucking horrible he is in this and how terrible that character is. And even for as much as we built him up, Benicio del Toro has some funny parts, but, like, he's not... He's barely in it.
He's
like
barely in it.
I'm sort of like, how did I remember all these things as being so awesome? And I'm not just me or us, but like the whole world, like remembers these things as incredible.
Yeah.
And this wasn't so long ago that like we were a whole different culture or something. So I was sort of watching it, just being a little mystified about how this one clicked so hard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I will say about the Benicio del Toro, I was like, first of all, we've got four white dudes and a Latin character. He's the first killed off. And I'm like, oh, right. He's effectively like, oh, let's kill off the black guy. Let's kill it.
Well,
like,
they kill off the most interesting. They're all weird, strong character types, which is, I think, the answer. One of the answers to your question, Keelan. Well, it stuck around because there's very memorable characters here. Like, you remember you remember Kevin Pollak.
Yeah.
You remember Gabriel Byrne. Yeah. I didn't remember
Gabriel Byrne was in the movie before we
started. Well, you know what's weird? I have things to say about that, but go ahead.
I was just going to talk about Pete Postlethwaite. Is he of Indian or Pakistani origin? Or is that a brown face?
I also thought that was weird, yeah.
And, well, he has a Japanese name. They call him a Limey, and yet he's doing some indistinct accent.
For sure Indian.
Yeah, like
Indian,
an Indian
South Asian, sub-Saharan. Yeah,
so, I mean, maybe their idea is, let's just stir this guy up in a pot and, like...
Maybe. Or maybe it's the story.
Maybe that's the idea. But then at the end, we see that he's really wearing brown face, which is weird. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, I guess, like, speaking to my earlier point about how there are no women or people of color in this, like... There was every opportunity to mix up everyone, and they basically were just like, now we got these four white guys, which is a sign of that time. So I'm not gonna, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that said, even in the shadow of Pulp Fiction, like, you know, black people were cool in the 90s too. Like, there's no reason not to put some cool characters in here.
Yeah.
And at the end, it's funny because we watched one of the movies that we did on our show was Boondock Saints, and you know, McManus, the sort of hothead, young, you know, Irish-y asshole.
Yeah.
Fucking that stock character is maybe the worst stock character we've ever had in the history of movies. That guy sucks. And I couldn't wait for him to die. And it sucked that he was last or second to last.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but let me say this about Gabriel Byrne, because this was interesting watching this movie. I watched not so long ago. I mean, I've seen it a million times also, but not very long ago did I revisit Miller's Crossing, and who's the star of that? And he's so effective, I think, in Miller's Crossing, in his sort of silent, kind of taciturn, you know, man, you know, film noir man character guy. And he's doing the same thing here, and the character is worse in this because there's not that much of a character. He's got like two dimensions, you know. He's trying to whatever, but he's basically doing the same performance. He's in the wrong movie. I am interested in the movie he's in, which is a serious crime film, basically. This is not that. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that you don't remember him, because he isn't playing to the rafters.
Right.
He's doing something trying to do something quite a bit more subtle. The material isn't really there.
Right.
And so it was interesting to me to watch him trying to be in, you know, mileage may vary, but a better movie, perhaps, than anybody else, and they all stick out way stronger, you know. And I thought that was interesting to see. It's that's just a question, I guess, of tone or knowing what you're in.
I liked that. I agree with you, but also I liked that. I liked that there was this sort of weird center of the film where things sort of rotate around, and like there's these really not caricatures but broad characters surrounding Gabriel Byrne.
Oh, they're caricatures.
Well, in a way that is appealing to me, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah, I kind of like
it's not necessarily bad.
Yeah, it's a caricature I like, so I'll call it a caricature. But
it's hard to call them characters.
Yeah, I have no idea anything about any of them. I just
call them character itchers.
Character itchers. But I remember Gabriel Byrne, and I like him in the film, not because I think his performance is exceptional, but because it those five people don't work without someone like that.
Almost like they need a straight man.
And he kind of functions that way a little bit. You know, it adds, because if you didn't have someone taking the situation seriously while Stephen Baldwin's throwing a temper tantrum and Jill Notaro's wandering in the background aimlessly, it would be really extra weird. But because Gabriel Byrne is immobile in the center of the frame most of those scenes, it grounds it in a weird way.
When I was a kid, and I loved this movie, I started doing, I don't know if you remember this, but there's a part where Gabriel Byrne is sitting there in a chair. And he starts clicking his nail on his tooth, and I also thought it doesn't he's sitting there in angst waiting for his girlfriend or whatever, and he starts going like this, and I always thought that was the weirdest tick, because what practical purpose could you possibly have by clicking your own fingernail against your tooth, and yet it doesn't look forced. I'm that guy definitely that's a tick, really, but I was how would you ever develop that tick?
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
Did you do it?
I remember doing it. I would try to affect that casually and be try to be cool like that.
Right, that's the super cool move. Another thing, speaking of that, it's real world effect on you. Me and my friend, for years, would say what about you, guy? And I didn't realize that was from this movie. So I'm my God, that's where we got that. We'll say that on I'm going to go with my friend, to this party. What about you, guy? That's what he says to Verbal Kent, Stephen Baldwin's character does.
Well, that scene's amazing. There's a scene very early. Well, okay. Here's the story. We throw to the guest a quick recap of the film. You can just do a very, very, very breezy version of this is the usual suspects. This is kind of the arc of the story.
All right, so I'll do it and you guys can jump in. But basically, should I do scene by scene-ish?
No. If this takes more, this is a great test for you. We were talking at the beginning of this about writing log lines.
Yeah.
So this should take you 60 seconds or less.
Okay. So basically five guys. I'm already blowing it. Five guys end up being put on in a lineup. At a police lineup, and then in the cell later where they're all in the holding cell, they're like, they should never do this. Usually it's one real criminal and four idiots, but we're all together. Why are we all together? And then they're like, well, if we're all together, let's fucking get the cops for doing this.
Can I also, this is also part of the thing, is that we interrupt the story. Just to say, this is another movie where the crime is so bad, because they're supposed to be incredible. Their operations are so lame.
Their operations are telling
a fake story.
I want to get to this idea, too, that Verbal Kent is a criminal mastermind.
Oh, right.
Why are you here? I designed the heist. And we boxed them in and then stole their money. And then we set the car on fire. Sorry, go on. That's something I want to talk about because it's absurd. Yeah, yeah.
So these five guys start doing crimes that are kind of irrelevant, but they do dumb shit crimes that don't really speak to me in any way, they're really doing it. And then finally they are tasked with they're forced into doing a $91 million deal in which there's going to be a drug deal, and then they can get the $91 million, and Kaiser Soze is going to get to keep the drugs.
Right, so they've run afoul of this supposed criminal mastermind, underworld mastermind guy named Kaiser Soze, who has this deep legend of murder and criminality. And he has fooled them or forced them, like Todd said, into doing his bidding.
Yeah,
and
the only reason
to
they're
the
not
script he has something on each of them.
Yeah, he has something on each of them, and the only reason they're not all dead is because they didn't know they were directly affecting him. But now the bill is up, and they have to go do this thing for him. And so they go on this boat to get the money, kill all the people, so we can have the drugs. There are no drugs on the boat. There's one witness that Kaiser Soze once dead, they figure out, and then he dies. And so the whole movie is told sort of this guy Verbal Kent is in the police office and he's telling them the story of what happened under duress. And then at the end of the movie.
And not to just be petty about these things, but the movie, it just doesn't stay consistent to any one thing. So even when he's supposed to be telling a story, there's all sorts of scenes where he's not there. It's happening all the time. And for a structure like this, that's pretty irresponsible. I don't know how you get away with that, or how you would think you would get away with that, because it's just sloppy beyond belief. So I'm never even sure if I'm supposed – this is perhaps irrelevant, but I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to be in Chaz Palminteri's head or in Kevin
point
Spacey's
of view is
head.
Very, very stressful.
That's a great point because your point of view as the viewer is never consistent or established for like one thing. So it's
how many scenes is Kevin Spacey not in the flashback things?
Well, the very beginning is when they're arresting Gabriel Byrne. So that one I can buy because that's Chaz Palminteri. At least he's there.
That's happening in real world.
Yes.
Sure.
And then the main one is, which is a terrible scene in lots of ways, where Gabriel Byrne and Stephen Baldwin are inside the boat.
Right.
And Gabriel Byrne claims he's searched every single room in the boat.
Well, that's a bad
There's no coke on the boat!
I'm telling you there's
I'm
no coke!
I'm telling you there's
I've
no
been
coke
in every
on the boat!
Room, down every... Holloway, which is, it's just it doesn't it. We all leapt out of the movie at that point because it just doesn't even make any sense, and it's because
we know about one room on the boat that has this.
Well, we've been watching, benefit of the doubt, I guess you could think is that guy lying. I guess like to fuck with Stephen
Baldwin. Beyond that, besides the climactic sort of boat scene, are there perspective breaks? Because I remember, I believe that you're right, but when I think back to these scenes, I remember the camera always kind of panning over and being like, oh, and he's in the background watching.
Kevin Spacey, and one time
the movie
was
out of its way to do that. I'm just wondering if I missed other point of view breaks.
I don't know.
There was one scene I remember, but not well enough to describe it, but there was one scene where it sort of panned and we saw verbal Kent listening, and I was like, oh, that was a really smartly done shot because we're, you know, in retrospect, knowing how it ends, that I'm like, oh, I'm being led to this guy is paying attention.
I mean, there are scenes where Gabriel Byrne is having very discreet conversations with his girlfriend that certainly Kevin Spacey can't hear from the subway across the street.
Right.
He's having these sort of, they ruined me in the tonight. Yeah. Like, it's just, I don't know. I mean, these are small things, and normally in a movie like this in particular, I wouldn't care. But it's, I don't know why it's got under my skin, but the reputation of this movie as being this sort of, like, extraordinary act of revelation.
Yeah.
I'm like, but you just shot all your rules to hell at every stage. And I guess, like, I could convince myself intellectually there's something anarchic about that and sort of fun, but
not,
I wasn't having a good enough time.
I actually had a fine time. I did. I mean, I got a little drowsy in the second act, I'll be honest with you.
I nodded off about 2 seconds twice.
But that's where I was at also. I was a little drowsy. I had a fine time, but I found it not worthy of the praise that had been lavished upon it.
Okay, but I really want to dig deep into that. What was going on in 95 where this is an Academy Award nominated film multiple times over? It caught the entire world's attention.
Made everybody's career, basically.
Exactly. Launched like 5 careers. Yeah. What was happening? I feel like I say this all the time on the show. It's not bad. It's okay. But it's not that special, except that it acts special. Is that all it is?
I will say that I think one of its great engines is when they all get rounded up. And that moment of of Kevin Pollak being like, you bring enough guys? Like, that's such a profoundly funny line. And then, and each of them, how they get rounded up, except Gabriel Byrne, which is as boring as his character has to be sometimes.
Well, can we just say what he's pitching in the moment where he's arrested?
What was he pitching?
So Gabriel,
I can't wait to hear this.
So here's the character,
like,
okay?
I miss this, but
Gabriel Byrne is supposedly an ex-cop who went dirty and spent some time in jail. This is all confirmed. Where he did or did not shiv a guy.
Super weird moment there.
Weirdly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we'll have to talk
about
that.
I don't buy that for a second, that Gabriel Byrne's in prison shiving guys.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but now he's out. There's some weird circumstances about where the other cops think he may have died. And so we find his first scene in the movie is he's at a fancy restaurant with his lawyer girlfriend talking to two French dudes.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get them to invest in this new idea he has, which is a non-themed restaurant where every so often it changes menu items and options.
And the walls.
And yet not the overall quality.
Holy shit. That's talked about?
That's his pitch.
I allowed that to glance over.
His pitch in this movie for how he gets himself out of a life of crime is this inane, cockeyed scheme for restaurant.
A restaurant that, you know, we changed some menus. Our menu room as well. Oh, like restaurant?
Well, like, but I think he's pitching different cuisines. No,
it'd be like Japanese, and it'd be like, yeah. And we'd change the walls a little bit to sort of reflect the cuisine of the time.
And I wish to God, that one of the things I was maddest about is that Chaz Palminteri came in and interrupted him when he goes, right. I'll give you an example. I wanted to hear that so bad.
Oh my God, the writer couldn't wait to get Chaz Palminteri in there. Yeah. Jesus, that's hilarious. What example could you have?
I think it's Japanese one day, and then overnight it becomes Italian. I guess the example he's about to give probably.
He was really counting on these French investors.
Yeah, but also French people are going to fucking invest in this.
Yeah, French known for their diverse cuisine.
Exactly.
Right. At the end, when he comes out of the jail cell, and he asks his lawyer girlfriend how to go after I left, what happened? She's like, they need some more time to think about it. He's like, God damn it. Like, right. He's so mad.
Yeah, they ruined me in there.
You mean after you were taken away by cops, being accused of robbing a boat full of guns? They were supposed to go, yeah, we're all in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also, like, these two dudes are all you've got left? Probably. Yeah. That fucking idea.
Also, they didn't.
Done.
It's a huge victory for him. What happened? They didn't say no.
They didn't say no.
Yes.
Should be like, holy shit. That feels like a win.
She said they need more time. He's like, fuck.
God, he should have been like, I'll hold out for... I mean, these idiots don't already know to say no? Jesus, no. I guess they don't speak... And they didn't seem to speak any English.
Not at all.
It wasn't subtitled when they were speaking French. It was fine. I got it. Like, she's just like, it's weird. They pulled him out. But these guys didn't seem to understand what was going on speaking French. So was he... I didn't hear him speak any French. He was speaking English.
They didn't
understand the pitch.
Oh, also, am I wrong? Or
thinking about it. Hold on. They literally had to record what he said and send it to a translator.
That's why they need time.
So they found out. Yeah. But now they had the fucking worst idea in the history of the world. That's why they needed more time. They don't speak English. Okay, sorry.
No, this is connected. Did they tell us earlier in the film that he'd been dead ostensibly for 2 years and
What the fuck was that about?
Or did that just come at the end?
No, they told us before.
They're like, oh, he faked his own death.
Yeah. They say that before he says that to Kev, that whole thing about how he walked into a building that blew up. That, you know, before that he's supposed to have been dead. Because in the cell, they're all like, I heard you were dead and like all this stuff.
That is something I would have pulled out of there as soon as I read a draft of my friend's script. Yeah. Like, dude, what the fuck that he was dead?
Well,
2 years?
That's the Kaiser Soze. I guess we're supposed to think that's the tie.
Again,
but I'm wondering if he's been dead and he's in hiding. Why he chose to come out in a fancy restaurant, or had he been maybe doing soft pitches around town?
And in that yellow suit, too. I mean, I thought that was a bad
Gabriel Byrne claims he's just been living his life. He's like, that was your mistake. Your mistake.
Right.
It's like, it wasn't his fault that they thought he was dead for 2 years. But
he's literally like, if they would have knocked on his door, he'd be like, opened it and like, hey.
That's what he says in the movie. He's like, I was just walking around as me.
I don't think that's true.
It's so weird. I found that to be really like, this is not going to hold up against the stress test. Why was that necessary? They also don't give us enough lines to this. So yeah, he didn't need to be dead for 2 years.
Well, I think there was a draft at least where there was more signs pointing to him being
that's
Kaiser
true.
Soze. And that's certainly a vestige of that.
Yeah.
If not a current idea to that.
Yeah, I bet. You know what? I bet you... Perhaps even more than a draft. I bet there was a cut of this that had a lot more of that stuff in it.
Yeah.
But it was probably very boring. The other thing I would say that this movie struck me now, which is we're finding this on a number of movies that we've watched, is this is clearly a film, to me at least, written by a very young guy. Mm-hmm. Perhaps even and made by a very young guy. It feels very, and I don't always mean this negatively. In this case I kind of do, I guess, but it feels very immature. Like the filmmaking and storytelling, while sometimes flashy, is not very what's the word? Evolved.
Yeah. It felt lightly idealistic almost.
Like, yeah, it's like cute. It's like, oh, my first movie. In fact, it's called Brian, the first credit on the movie is strange. It's Bryan Singer's film, The Usual Suspects.
A credit I've never seen before.
Oh, weird.
Very strange credit. And it made me, it sort of looks like I remember when I was a kid, I had like a little tape player called My First Sony.
Oh.
It was kind of like that. I felt like this is my first movie.
Right.
Going back to the ending, I wonder, in response to your question, why was it such a landslide popularity contest winner? I'm trying to think of other movies that pulled off this structure or purported to or convinced you at the time that they did pull off this structure in a way that felt pleasurable. right. around this time period, and I'm not sure that there were...
I have the answer for you. And what I did not know when I watched this the last every time, what I've seen since I saw this movie is Mamet's movie House of Games. Mm. House of Games is this movie, and to the point where they stole Chaz Palminteri, where the dialogue is clearly written in a sort of faux Mamet speak style.
Wait, is House of Games the one? Was that Sean Penn in the where? Is that what I'm thinking of?
This is a con. That's a the con.
Con movie.
Yeah, I know that one.
Oh, I don't know.
And Chaz Palminteri plays a con artist, and it's I think Lindsay Krause or whatever. It's David Mamet's wife, and that movie also. To me, is not it's not like that scintillating, but it's better than this because it's sort of about itself in a way. It's not quite so serious. It's like weird and funny, but that I think is the same. I watching this, I was like, oh, that's where they got this. They just were Mamet fans, especially Christopher McQuarrie. He's a big Mamet fan. He loved that movie probably.
I bet you this movie because I do think the last sequence, although kind of goofy. Is well cut and is paced correctly. Like this is the scene where Kevin Spacey's club foot basically turns into a normal foot in this one tracking shot, and you know Chaz Palminteri scans the board, and the movie does lie to you and give you the impression that there's lots of connections he's making when really it's Skokie, Illinois Barbershop Quartet and you know some extra things that he did with
a
Guatemala
fat
coffee.
Lady when he says well, a fat person
that wasn't very nice.
No, and it was that's like cruel. That's where he got the idea of a fat person from that picture for like
so the movie does that while amidst trying to convince you that there's everything he said was on that board, which is certainly not true, but that's what the movie's telling you happened, and I think that feeling is still a pleasurable feeling. You're like, oh shit, that's certainly the feeling you had watching it for the first time. And I think it's cut and paced so well that the success of the film, I think initially, is based on that sequence.
I agree because that moment where he starts walking normal, it's exhilarating.
It's great.
Exhilarating is the perfect word because you really get swept up in it. And that's true. And the music is sort of going at this sort of high pitch. And I would say that this is a thing I said earlier about the movie embracing a kind of old-fashioned aesthetic is like its Hollywoodness really works in this sequence, and sometimes throughout the whole movie is it's big swelling scores for a 90s indie crime movie is unusual.
Yeah.
And it feels different, I suppose.
I will say we were correct about Benicio del Toro for the most part. He's weirder, not weirder than I remembered, but he's real weird.
He's real weird. I mean, he looks so young. I would say he's weirder than I remember. He was, but like
he does look so young.
Really, unrecognizable. Yeah. Literally, even compared to Fear and Loathing.
Big time.
Way different.
His character is, and he's so amazing in every single scene. He's so joyful and like brings so much energy. And then he's the first to be murdered, and I was like, couldn't you kill Kevin Pollack's character?
Yeah.
You know, like,
I could have dealt with less Kevin Pollack and more Benicio del Toro.
Yeah.
and it's great that they let him do this, but there's quirky moments all over the place. He's wandering around the back. He's got these weird tics and physical quirks. Yeah. His verbal quirks are awesome. And there's this one shot when Stephen Baldwin's walking over to talk to Gabriel Byrne, and you see his hand come out of the bottom of the frame, and it's Benicio del Toro's fist. And they do a fist bump.
Well, he goes to give him a low five, and he gives him a fist, and he winds up slapping his fist, which is so funny.
Yeah. It's great.
Weirdly, probably my favorite scene in the whole movie. This is again, this movie just has a lot. I'm arguing with myself on this, and I know, but it just has a lot of iconic stuff that is broad and sort of lucky to be as iconic as it is, but I remember it all and it's very vivid. Like the lineup scene where they have to say, give me the keys, you fucking cocksucker. Okay, Stephen Baldwin nearly ruins it.
Yeah.
But when they get to Benicio del Toro, I assume and hope it was just what was going on while they were shooting. He starts laughing and can't stop laughing, and they're messing around. And like the jokes that he's sort of telling in this character accented way are super funny, and that actually was the only thing in the movie that really felt like real. Like it felt like, oh, these criminal guys are sort of joking around with each other. Everything else was sort of hyper scripted.
I think that is actually sort of behind the scenes moment.
Yeah,
I think that is a real thing.
They're probably laughing at what he's doing. Yeah. He's probably being so funny. Like that is so funny to watch somebody do.
Yeah, and it's give me the keys, you fucking cocksucker. Like
yeah,
the way they all. I mean,
what the fuck?
That speaks to what I was saying earlier about that. The I. iconography of this and like why it was so loved. I think it is like the final scene and then those early scenes where we're introduced to these characters.
Yeah.
Because they're criminals, but we're just like, I fucking love these dudes.
Yeah, but yeah. That also that the way that's shot, it's normally it's the getting the team together shots where you show Ocean's 11 style, where it's this is the locksmith and this is the guy. Right. They use the same structure to introduce the way these guys were picked
you're
up.
Right.
But that's not the tone of the rest of the film. And so I think that I was into that sequence because I'm like, oh, this is cool, this is quirky. That's not that movie.
Yeah. It's
completely ripped off from a heist movie.
Yeah, and them pulling their what should be incredibly entertaining heists are lame criminal ops. Like,
what's
lame.
The first heist? I can't even remember.
They box the cop car in.
Yeah. They box the cop car in.
Here's the heist. So we're giving massive build up to this. We're said we need five guys to do this.
And
right
they
now.
Have got to be fucking good.
Good.
Yeah, like these guys.
We need the best guys. We need you to do. Otherwise,
it'll be murders. Like, we're gonna have to kill people if we don't have the five.
This and he goes, like De Niro's team in Heat. Level
These guys. And the whole thing is, we can't do this without you, Gabriel Byrne. Like, you have to join the team. We need five guys. And the heist is, they got three vans. And they basically sandwich a cop car, and then the third van comes on the side, and so the cop car can't go anywhere. They hold up guns and go, give us the money.
Really? I guess they do need five guys because you need the guy in the front cop car pointing the gun at the cops because you need the guy still driving the front car, the front van.
That's four.
Wait. You need one guy to jump up and take a sledgehammer to the windshield. You're forgetting that guy.
But do you need that guy?
Yeah, because he has to go in.
But here's what I'm positing. Do you need the guy with the sledgehammer?
The other thing is that this movie...
absolutely.
This
you don't
plot.
Know how to run a heist. That's epic. That's your problem.
wait, hold on. Before I go to this, imagine the pitch. So Kevin Spacey is like, okay, here's what's happening. We sandwich the cop car, and then we pull up a third van, and everyone's like, good. He's like, then you can help with a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
And then you hammer in the windshield. Then you pull out gas. You dump it on the car. At what point are people like, wait, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, compare that to what they describe as the other plan that he's replacing, which is... Stephen Baldwin wants to go in shooting. That's his plan.
Yeah, his plan is you're going to have to kill people.
This master criminal is going to go in there just killing everybody. And like, that's his. So they're like, okay, we got to top that.
Right.
So any idea that anybody has is fucking brilliant by comparison.
Yeah. But also, like, we're getting at something important, which is like, all they were doing, just to give some context, if you've forgotten this, if you've seen the movie, the cops are... shady, and they basically pick up drug dealers or diamond dealers or whatever, and then they escort them. So people, you know, it's like hundreds of dollars a mile, but then they get the protection of the cops. So they box in these two bad cops with this fat dude in the back, this orca sized guy. Like, really, they didn't have to flash to a picture of a poor woman. But they, and this guy gives them a bunch of cash, and they're like, you can go all the way to Cape Cod for this much, which I thought was a dumb line. Like, they should have been like, it'll barely get you there, because if you're paying all this money. Anyway, and then they, so they do that, and then they corner this cop, or they box him in, and then they use the sledgehammer to get the windshield out for no reason, and then they grab the cash and the diamond, or the jewels, I think they're emeralds.
He handed them over, let's be clear. Well,
and then they light the car on fire as they pull away.
And then the second op is even dumber, which is that they want to steal some jewels from a guy who has two bodyguards. And so we've just seen this totally unimpressive car box-in where they're at least wearing masks. This one, they're just walking up there with guns and saying, give me the diamonds.
Yeah,
that's the whole thing.
The pitch is we catch them in a car garage and we hold our guns to them and they give us the items.
And every single one of us talks. We all show our faces.
Yeah.
Except for Gabriel Byrne, who's wearing a Zorro mask.
Yeah. That is hilarious. I didn't even think
importantly,
about how it.
But also talks the whole time.
And also can't pull the trigger, which I guess is supposed to be the one thing we go, yeah, I should have known he wasn't Kaiser Soze. But I also took it to be like, oh, he's reluctantly being a criminal again. But
also, Stephen Baldwin's costume is a rebel flag hat.
Confederate flag hat.
That's his costume.
Like,
you'd never remember that. Like this. And so anyway, so all to say that this, the middle portion, which should be demonstrations of the incredible quality that these guys bring to, you know, crime, is totally blown. And
like,
so you're just watching five like Yahoo dorks, you know, go through a bunch of stuff, and then they finally get to the ending. The other thing I was going to say is, I was thinking about what the benefit of the doubt I was hoping to give the film. This is what I sometimes I do this, being totally transparent. before watching the movie, I was like thinking of like cool stuff I could say about it, like assuming I was going to like the movie. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I thought was, okay, I'm going to, a good argument for why this movie is smart is that, okay, maybe everything that he reveals in the end negates the entire film that you just watched.
Right.
But that's movies. And there's like this sort of beautiful idea of like, well, it's all crazy make-em-ups. So who cares? Right. He made up a crazy story and then it was like not that story. So who's to say that that's any different than watching a movie? But it's so boring. It's way more boring than that. So I can't, that argument doesn't even hold up. It's not a very entertaining story he tells.
Right. And it's not even, it's not even really the point of that thing. I was hoping for something that I didn't get to, which was a movie where you have to go through and pick out, because here's how POV could have helped them. This is the thing, the beef I have with the film, is that any point of view that Chaz Palminteri would have had access to would have had to coincide with the story he heard from Verbal Kent, because he would have had access to those moments, right? Yeah. So weaving in a fictional story that then coincides with the things that he knows that Chaz Palminteri knows, that's cool and clever and hard and challenging to write, but also very rewarding.
Yeah.
That's what I expected to see.
Yeah.
It's the movie I kind of remember. Yeah. It is not, 0% of that happens. And I'm kind of surprised by it. And you know, not to say that I was bored the whole time, but that's what the movie I think wanted to be.
Right. Well, yes, but the movie, I don't, can a movie that exudes such confidence in its sort of mild to unimpressive storytelling get over that hump? I mean, like, that's sort of what I feel like must have happened. The more I think about it, the more we talk about it, I'm like, well, this movie was just so bold with its, like, presentation of, like, ta-da,
right,
that people were like, what? Like, their fucking eyes spun around in their head, and they were like, well, I mean, I'm not going to think about it again because that would ruin it. But based on that feeling I walked out with, fucking 4 stars. Oscars.
Well, that's that shot on the billboard again. The movie says everything he just said was on this billboard, this cork board, and it's not there. And that to me sums up the film for me, is that you do leave with that feeling.
Right.
You leave with the feeling that the movie worked and that the movie did all the things that I thought in retrospect it had done.
Right.
It doesn't do any of those things.
Right.
And this is a movie I'm really happy to have watched. It's a movie I've been wanting to rewatch for a very long time. I'll probably never watch this again.
Yeah. I will never watch this movie again.
You know what else
I can't imagine.
Say? That's actually just to, it's the same. I'm going to make the exact same point you just did, but just sort of emphasize it in a slightly different way, is that it's the middle act plus is really dull, and yet I was really fighting to, because of my memory of The Usual Suspects, I was really fighting to follow the plot.
Yeah.
And what I came away with is the plot is dumb. The plot, nothing really of any interest happens, and yet you're kind of bored throughout. So this may have worked to the movie's advantage, is my point, is that when you get to the end and they're like, all this stuff, flash, you're like, whoa, where was I when all this shit was going on?
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
Man, this movie really got by me. Like, they tricked me, and I was thought I was bored. But no, I was not bored.
Yeah,
I was being fucking hypnotized.
I was being set up for grand finale.
There's literally no second act, right? Isn't that what we're basically coming to? Because, like, I just, what's interesting about what we're talking about is I said, you know, oh, this is the moment I'd love the movie. And that was the moment with the briefcase exchange. What I'm realizing is nothing interesting had happened, or nothing that was of any, I mean, Stephen Baldwin takes two guns and shoots guys, which, by the way, is totally ridiculous at the same time. And
everybody shoots sideways in this movie, by the way. This is like the Boys in the Hood style side.
Which I found offensive that they were like, no, we're also gangsters this way. And they drive away in a van that has two blood things on it.
I was so perplexed by that.
Yeah,
that really.
That's a part of this masterful parking garage scene, which at least theoretically goes wrong.
Right.
But they drive out in a white van splattered with blood.
And then the scene cuts to the other side of the van. And you hear this like clanking sound, and I remember thinking, "Well, they're cleaning the van."
Right,
is what I thought. That's not true.
That's not true. And like, so this idea that when this guy brings a briefcase, you realize we're now being accelerated into something meaningful, because for a long time we've just been fed like low grade dumbass heists.
Not even meaningful, but you have a sense that there's an actual plot.
That's
afoot.
What it is. Yeah.
Well,
the
answer is, I mean, Act Two is there's a guy named Kaiser Soze. Now, nothing that they say about Kaiser Soze means anything.
Right.
It doesn't add up to anything. But this movie fucking hits it with the bullet points.
Right.
Kevin Spacey tells a little story, and what you remember is he's a ghost story for criminals.
Right.
Like, that's what you remember. And it's like, oh, cool idea for a guy.
Also, like, can we talk about this for a second? So there's a seed of a good idea here, which is the flashback, which is the only thing that we know is made up in the film, that we're told in the moment's fictional, is the flashback scene of Kaiser Soze killing his family.
Was that thing shot on VHS?
It's VHS. It's shot in like uber crazy Dreamtown, and Kaiser Soze looks like Tommy Wiseau with like a long wig on. And I could not figure out like what the situation was that they were trying to do. But then I thought, oh, this is the germ of a good idea of separating fake storytelling from fake real storytelling.
Right. Yeah. Right,
that
yeah,
was
right,
such right. a good opportunity, right. I thought. But in retrospect, it's just a crazy, weird scene.
For a movie that is so that is relatively, at least if not necessarily sophisticated and bold with its filmmaking choices and not inept by any means, what was up with this sequence? Like, why does it look like that? Why did they think that was going to be powerful?
And also, shouldn't we have watched Kevin Spacey tell that story and kind of like get emotional, or like to where we go, oh shit, this dude, like in the rewatching, we go, oh man, he did this. He's talking about himself now, and it's very clear.
Well, but it doesn't add up. Nothing. Right. That doesn't Nothing still adds like up. That's the thing. Is like you don't put Kevin Spacey in place of the Tommy Wiseau ghost guy.
Right.
Like you can't. That you doesn't can't work. Do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what though? I'm sorry. I hate when I do this. It's more annoying to me even than to you guys and to my listeners, but our listeners.
Mostly
but,
to me.
But I, Kevin Spacey is good at looking scared. He has some really good scary faces. And and the reason this Kaiser Soze legend works is because he's saying, who's Kaiser Soze, getting more and more scared by the severity that's hit the room. Everybody else is kind of going glum and quiet, but his face is really effective. So one point in Kevin Spacey's corner.
Right.
So to use that to bridge, regardless of the fact that it's not a very good movie, maybe. Good, but not great.
Weirdly.
But we still kind of enjoyed. How does somebody watch this movie now? Can someone watch this movie now, given the Kevin Spacey news, given the Bryan Singer story? Like, what happens to this movie now?
I think it's interesting with the Bryan Singer factor plus the Kevin Spacey. Because if it's just Kevin Spacey, you can be like, well, you can watch it one more time and just be like, well, he's one of five.
Right.
But the Bryan Singer thing, you're kind of like, man, Jesus, that's some dark pedophile.
Do you watch Chinatown still?
Yeah.
Chinatown?
Definitely.
News?
It's a great movie.
I guess that's my question.
So I wish this were a great movie because this would be a more interesting conversation.
That's kind of what I'm driving at.
But in this case, I'm imagining saying to a kid or a new film watcher or whatever who wasn't alive for all this, like, okay, there's this movie, and it blew people's minds in 1995. However, the lead actor is a probable child molester, and the director has very similar accusations. It's also not very good anymore. But you need to know this movie. Like,
I feel like
it's just
a bad lead into it.
But how would you ever say? But I guess what I mean is, like, history is what it is now. The reality is what it is now. I don't know how to explain this.
It's a less complicated question than I thought it would be, because the movie's not as good as I thought it would be.
Yeah.
It's a fine movie. It's not in the top 10 of the movies we've watched on this podcast, I would even suggest.
It's not even in the top 50.
It's in the bottom 28.
Well, maybe the bottom.
We've watched some real rough movies on this podcast. I think the basic question is interesting. I'm more interested in having that question, that debate about other films that are better.
Right.
Just because I had a fine time. I really enjoyed watching this movie. I'm happy we watched it. I feel like it's a hollow film.
So is that to say we, from now on, not just us literally, but as a sort of film culture, can kind of let this one go?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was thinking, like, what if people remade this, which is a weird thing, but, you know, with IP being what it is, people are willing to do that. And they put in characters of color. They put in women into the main team. You know, like, this movie, nobody needs to be a dude in this movie. You know, like,
well, you can't. Yes, I hear you, but you can't recapture the spirit of Discovery,
right? And that's
and
I thought
that
about
all
that.
This movie has to trade on,
but right
as and IP,
maybe. But I thought, you know, maybe another generation goes, I don't know any of this stuff, but you could redo it and actually fix the things we're talking about.
Yeah,
a little bit.
You could make a better movie. There's make a better movie.
You could have a second act. You could have a real heist.
Yeah, but you could.
You wouldn't remake The Sixth Sense, though, for example.
Right.
You'd never do that.
Yeah, you just don't need to. I would say,
and it would be a very odd person who says, "I want to remake The Usual Suspects because it's not very good." Like, that'd be a really weird instinct.
Yeah, I can fix this.
Yeah.
It does feel very fixable, but, you know, again, for young, mid-20s probably?
Or maybe potentially even younger.
Yeah, I'd love to know how old they're. But, honestly, like, that's impressive for them, but it's definitely not impressive by sort of modern standards, right. I would say.
What was the budget? Do you know what the budget was?
It feels it low. Yeah. But Travis said this very early on, in a clever way. It's cleverly made.
It opens and ends with a boat explosion that they cut around and do cool way, because they didn't have money to blow up a boat.
Singer was 30 when he made this. 29, 30.
He's got that vampire blood in him.
Can we talk about the fact that there's a moment, so the guy that needs to get assassinated, the Kaiser Soze once dead, he's floating in the river. He's also killed in the guts of this boat, the deep, deep guts of this boat. How did he, did Kaiser Soze like walk him out? Because the explosion.
I guess the explosion blew him out.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem the boat really exploded, because like the way they talk about it was kind of like there were no drugs on the boat, so the cocaine wouldn't have been incinerated.
We could go on a deep dive into this. Yeah. Where were the drugs?
Also, thing. We do see the boat afterwards, and it's just simply smoldering.
It's just sitting there. I know, and they're like, no one could have survived that.
The boat's basically intact.
Yeah.
Again, that's a budgetary thing, so I get it. I'm not hating on them, but clearly the boat was not blown up.
Yeah, so how did that body get out into the middle of the water?
Look, you're asking the wrong questions right now.
He
sat him right on that dynamite box and said, he went straight
to hell.
Yeah.
It's also, can I just say one more thing?
Yeah.
It's I don't know how to say this given the circumstances about the actor and the filmmaker, but there's a lot of gay bashing. There's a like cocksucker is in it a lot. And I know we don't generally think of that as like gay bash, but if you're gay, I would think like that you know that that's kind of a slur. And fucking horrible Stephen Baldwin has this line which I did remember as it was coming up, and I was like, I know what he's about to say. But why is it in here if you're a gay director, young gay director? And I didn't get it.
Yeah, I agree with you. The 90s were coming out of the late 80s. Is the best way of saying it, I think. That it just felt like the easiest, and this movie does go for some easy jokes. I will say, just as a corollary to that, there's some good lines in this movie. I think I think Chris McQuarrie has some really good little turns of phrase and some cool dialogue. It's not cohesive to itself. Right. Like other crime movies have a genre of tone that's everyone's speaking in the same universe. That movie doesn't do that at all.
Yeah.
But there are some individual lines and phrases and conversations that are really great. And I just think that there's some easy jokes he goes for.
Yeah.
And one of those is that we should. Do you want to say the Stephen Baldwin joke so people don't think we're crazy?
Well, I don't really want to say it, but he's
Use the word F instead of the word.
All right, you can figure out what F stands for.
Fuck.
It's three letters. And Stephen Baldwin is up on the roof. And he's got a long-range rifle thing, and he sees like these guys down on the dock, and he is in a position to pick them off. And so he counts the guys. He goes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oswald was a F.
Yeah.
This. It's just but an then
easy joke.
It's just dumb. Yeah. It's just dumb. Yeah. And
it's just going for a laugh. It's going for a gag.
Which I bet it got. I'm sure it got it. Yeah. I'm sure it got the laugh.
Oh, for sure.
Then he sings Old MacDonald Had a Farm, and on that farm he shot some guys.
Right, which is funny line, but a stupid thing.
This character.
He's all over the map.
He's horrible. He's horrible. He's the only consistent character in that he's just pure garbage.
We're talking about larger context stuff, but I still wanted to drill down to some of it. It seems to me Verbal Kint is just saying a bunch of nonsense, and he has no plan, which is weird because he's a criminal mastermind, Kaiser Soze. But there's this moment where Chaz Palminteri starts saying, like, oh, it's this guy. And Verbal Kint doesn't seem like he's been leading him. He hasn't been leading him there the whole time, which now I'm like, why wasn't he sort of like, very intelligently, but like keeping a distance. Because then when he goes, it's him, it's Gabriel Byrne's character.
Yeah.
And he's just like, it can't be, we were friends. Like, that's great. I think that's smart by Kaiser Soze at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But also I'm like, you should have been dropping these little pieces.
Well, I mean, the structure of that con is if he, and again, we don't get this, so you're right. We don't get this in the film. But if he's been unintentionally, I'm putting air quotes up, listeners, if he's been unintentionally planting the seeds that Gabriel Byrne is Kaiser Soze, then lets Chaz Palminteri come to that conclusion, then seem shocked by it. That's a good con. You know, he's let the guy propose it. It's called finding the leather in the con world, right?
Right.
The movie doesn't give you enough of the seeds. So when Chaz Palminteri makes that leap, you just kind of go, like Kaelin said, like, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I suppose so. But again, even that sequence when the reveal, and this is what the movie does really well, actually, I think, that the when the reveal that Gabriel Byrne is Kaiser Soze comes, it's a bullshit reveal. Right. But it feels like a reveal. It's right. shot and cut in a way right. you're like, oh, oh, oh.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
feel like you're learning something. And then it reveals the guy on the dock with the hat is Gabriel Byrne.
Right.
And you're like, oh, maybe he's still alive. And maybe there's a twist coming where he's going to be there. Like, it's bullshit if you push on it, but it
right.
does feel
it
right.
It feels great.
It feels correct. And then you get a second reveal,
right.
which is the only reason we earn the second reveal is because we've let our guard down.
Right.
We think that we've seen the reveal. It's very smart.
That's
it just
that's
doesn't, it's not right.
That's yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And yeah, I wanted to get back yeah. to this idea of the corkboard because, dear listeners, what happens is like at the very corner it says Skokie Quartet, or it says Quartet and it's Skokie, and he says he was in a barbershop quartet in Skokie, Illinois, which is dumb but fine.
Couldn't you have put two different things together to tell, like, why is it?
Yeah,
that's my point. Is it dumb? It's really
it's
dumb.
So
dumb.
For a criminal mastermind, he's doing a very poor job
yeah.
of stringing things together.
And so when there's the big reveal, we're zipping past this board left and right and zipping, and I'm just like, stop so I can find one word that he's taken.
There's not.
And that's
yeah, yeah.
what you said earlier.
No, it's a lie.
Right.
The movie's lying to you.
He's,
yeah,
it's lying
but
to you.
But you do feel like.
But you feel good.
Oh,
you're like,
everything
oh.
is connected.
Yeah.
He made it all up.
But if
yeah.
he would have, like, if I were able to rewrite the scene with you guys, I feel like he would be picking apart the whole board so we could literally see names and whatever. And so the cop with him every once in a while might be, because Chaz Palminteri has a dumbass cop with him, he might be like, oh, I think, oh, I've heard of that or whatever. And what he's really using is his own board against him, but vaguely enough or like tying it in together. Something, just so that we... That board, we go, oh, shit, he literally picked, like, all these things because...
That's what it should be. You
yeah.
know, it's funny, though, if you think about the reality of the film in terms of what's happening, is that Chaz Palminteri's had this long two-hour and 20-minute interview with Verbal Kent, and he's got his story. He feels like he's got it all wrapped under control. Then sees Skokie, Illinois Quartet... and drops his coffee cup in shock.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
what
that
happens.
Is, that is hilarious.
So that's
weird.
It has
Kobayashi on the
well,
bottom
he hasn't
of the coffee
seen
cup.
That.
Right.
Yeah.
He
hasn't never
seen
anything
but
except
see
for Skokie, Illinois
right.
Quartet, and he's like, fuck.
Oh, no, then he looks the orca woman on there.
But he,
and then he's running over all these quotes
but
that
he's already
don't
dropped,
apply.
Yeah, but he's already dropped his coffee cup by that point.
Right. He,
so
you're
like,
right. He is
yeah.
like
he gets
so
stunned
shocked.
When he sees Quartet, Skokie, Illinois.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
And you get this really like slow motion coffee cup drop. That's a kind of a crazy character moment.
Yeah,
that's pretty ridiculous. Like if he had seen all of it and then he's just like,
I mean, all of it's kind
that
of
would have been
yeah.
okay.
It was funny at the end. We watched Dirty Rotten Scoundrels last week, and I felt having with a good memory of that movie that it played extraordinarily well a second time through. Again, not to repeat myself, I'm stunned that this would play to somebody else well a second time through, because when you're looking, you realize the absence of a story or a compelling hook. And I mean, yes, you can always rely on the style and the feeling of this movie, which is appealing, but that is not the thing that makes this movie. And so I'm just surprised that it has... I mean, maybe I don't even know what I'm talking about. Maybe it hasn't really lived on. I mean, I guess I don't hear people talking about Usual Suspects.
No,
so much
people don't
anymore.
Go back and rewatch it. It's actually perfect for a podcast. It's one that everyone says is awesome and that no one has rewatched.
And
right.
I mean, I do. I was glamorized by it.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, it's great.
Oh, yeah.
And now we're talking about it. I'm like, oh, man.
Totally.
I mean, you know what it reminds me of in a way better level in a way is Three Billboards outside of Ebbings, Missouri, which is like, can't take the least of a stress test before you're like, oh, this is just a white supremacist apology. But it feels good while you're watching it and you're like, oh yeah, this is okay, I guess. But like,
well, it's interesting. It has the same kind of style,
right.
hyper sort of broad, big style to it. Which I thought was odd when I watched that movie. But I think that actually isn't so far off of what this is. Like they're not nuanced.
Yeah.
Really. They're just kind of flash.
There was a woman in it, though,
people.
In the end.
That's
a woman
true.
Lawyer. So they did fit a woman into this movie.
Yeah, I think this is an enjoyable hollow experience. For me.
Yeah, watch it for the last time. That's what I would say.
Yeah,
rewatch it for
the
last
sequence
time.
Is good. I
yeah.
really
it
enjoyed
is,
the last
And sequence. Even the very last shot, I want to call it, that's when he goes, and then... He was gone.
Great,
and it goes to black. That
it makes
like,
you think it was awesome.
Yep.
It was awesome.
It's true.
They nailed it. They stuck the landing.
Yeah. If you're like a non Donald Trump fan, this movie is your greatest horror because he gets away at the end. But really, if you, you know, it's like you see the circle tightening and the noose tightening, but he ends up slipping out. But what you want is we want to see. I mean, and also you're sort of excited that this guy gets away. Wait a second. He's like a mass murderer. He will kill everybody in this room with nothing.
If he is, I mean, once again, this is actually not a complaint I have about the movie. But again, for somebody who just wants this on surface pleasure, I'm surprised that it fucking holds up because you don't know who this guy is at all. You don't know anything about what he's done. I suppose you know he orchestrated something to kill a guy on a boat. I guess you know that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, but
and
even
he killed
like
the guy.
The fact that his Pete Postlethwaite's name is not Kobayashi, but there is a Pete Postlethwaite who's his henchman.
Yeah,
is I'm just like okay. Like, who's that? Like,
well,
I guess.
Also, that drawing they do that they get the fax machine, it looks like Pete Postlethwaite and Kevin Spacey. Did you guys notice that? I was like,
it's not a great drawing.
Either. Yeah. No, it's not a great drawing.
Great drawing. Yeah, that's our second. Well, so just in terms of representation, that's our second movie we looked at with a guy in brown face. So that's exciting.
Was he really in brown face, or is he just tanned?
Impossible to say.
Yeah. Pete Postlethwaite.
I think it's very likely he was based on his accent he was doing.
Yeah.
Do you think that they just added in that limey guy because he didn't pull off whatever they were going for? And someone's like, let's just call him British.
I actually like your idea that he's an amalgam of bullshit because he's not a real person, but then you see him at the end and he is, and you're like, well, hold on. Yeah. So that real crazy
God,
amalgam
why couldn't
of characters.
Said something. Then we could have really known.
Yeah, I wish you would have talked to him and like, hello, Guffna. Even like, I get it.
That's what I thought. Like, yeah. I was just saying that if he would have spoken, which wouldn't have been good for the movie, but if he just talked and he wasn't, he just had,
hey, Jim.
He was something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then we go, he constructed, because that board that we were whipping through, the cork board, had an Irish samurai.
As right.
Like, well, speaking of low budget, I kind of loved the last shot of Chaz Palminteri where he's realized what's happened. He runs out of the police station and he's looking around and you can see the black car that they're driving away right there behind his shoulder, and it takes forever to turn right.
Yeah,
so I was
watching,
and I was like, the live traffic was like such a bitch in this moment because he's right there, like they're so close.
Yeah,
and like you could very easily see like they're probably in that car, and it's just sitting there, and then finally it turns off screen.
Kaiser Sose is like, oh,
but that is not
fuck.
The suspense the moment is playing.
All
right, ATZ.
Oh yeah,
tell us about Collision Theory.
Oh, my book. I'll just say the first chapter opens with a guy who's going up to a rooftop just to take a moment out of his life. He sees a woman who's about to jump and kill herself. So he invites her to dinner, and then he invites her to travel around the world, and then she jumps and kills herself. So that's just the first two pages. But after that, it launches into it's a very tight novel. I swear it can sustain stress tests. So
that's awesome.
You can push on it, but
you can get it anywhere. Order it on Amazon.
You can get it anywhere. Yeah, and
in bookstores now. That's good. And by the way, I said this the other night, but for real, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
We didn't even talk about this, but Todd has hosted for the last decade more.
12 years.
12 years. This incredible show called Literary Deathmatch, which tours the world. I mean, if you live in a cool place, it's probably been there or will be there soon. And it's a super great show that spotlights authors and writing and comedy in this really inventive, creative way. This success is a long time coming. And obviously, as a first book, it's a huge deal for
I'm so excited. So. And literally, I know if anybody's listening, you're like, I don't know if I'm going to get it. Like, my publisher and me, like, we care deeply if you buy one copy. Like, it means it's crazy when you realize, as an independent press and, you know, a first novelist, like, every sale really makes a difference. So if you think I'm as hilarious as Kaylin and Travis don't, then I don't know, pick it up. And it's a really fast read. It's
honestly
204 pages. You'll blaze through it.
That's cool. 204?
204.
It looks really big in the press photos.
I know. It's not. It looks Hold pretty on. Big.
It looks like a 450-page novel in the press photos.
Yeah, but it's 204. Wait,
but do you agree with me that it looks enormous?
It
in the
looks
press
like
photos?
A 310-page novel.
450
in the press
minimum.
Yeah.
How dare you?
209.
Would you guys also tweet? How can they find you online?
At @ATZaniga. And one thing I will say about the book that's kind of fun is to watch me on Twitter going up against like right-wing trolley assholes, because they'll eventually start
condemning me for having a book out or for being a quote blue check, which means I've got like the verified. And my favorite comeback, and I have pretty fun comebacks for these guys, but I told one guy, I go, you can't touch me. I spelled a whole book right. Like, it's pretty fun to taunt people.
God, like, yeah. I hope that guy bought your book and went through the highlighter.
That's what I said.
I'm going to get him. There's a comma out of place here. I'm going to find it.
One time I just tweeted like, hey, my book will be out in a week or something. Some guy wrote, this is the funniest tweet I've read all day. And I was like, I'm not going to touch that one. That one's good.
It's a good
like,
burn. It's a good burn.
Yeah, what a great burn.
Well, follow him, A.T. Zuniga. Please tweet at him if you read his books, if you read his book or buy it, and say snarky things to him.
Yeah. Our ceremony continues or concludes, Todd, with you drawing our next film.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited about this. Wow, you guys have 370 films in here for the next 22 episodes.
209 for sure.
So read for the people what will Travis and I and perhaps another person, but maybe just us,
do you think we'll like it? Do you think we'll like it, Todd?
I think this is an interesting one. Next week is Batteries Not Included.
Ooh.
We're going to come around to this one.
That's the writer, the Short Circuit writers?
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh boy.
Yeah, that's.
We have history with
I
those
heard
gentlemen.
It's better than Short Circuit.
Well, let's find out.
Next
week
on
Does Your Favorite
Movie
Suck.